Hey, quick question. Do you belong to Costco? Are you a Costco member?
Not, no.
I wasn't either until last week.
Ooh.
I finally signed up. It's a big deal. It's a big step. I kind of didn't care one way or another, you know?
Yeah.
But like all my other who I consider my adult friends, like people
Is that
who are
shy of
married.
me? Hey, hold on. I just told
Well,
you I wasn't a member, and you just
yeah, you're
continue,
borderline.
continue, continue.
So, like married and people with either kids or kids on the way in their 30s, like they all like in conversation, it's like the thing they're evangelical about now. Like, oh, you're not Costco? You gotta go to Costco. And then they spend like 10 minutes describing what they have. They got so much fish. Oh, they got, you know, all this stuff. It's just like they really want you to join. It's not like, hey, this would be convenient for you. It's like, you have to do this. And we finally, because of the diaper situation, it's like, we're like, okay, is it really that cheap? And so the wife sent me out to us like to scout. So like, okay,
Yep.
let's go find out if it's gonna be worthwhile. Because it's all the way across town.
Pretty far away.
It was kind of a pain, but you know, we can do it for. And it wound up like, okay, yeah, the diapers are cheap enough, it's worth it. Because they charge you a membership fee.
Yeah.
I spent like an hour just wandering around, kind of like in awe. It's like a weird mix of like retail and a warehouse. I mean, it was kind of depressing.
So what did you when you talked to do they have like I've never been in a Costco. I mean, I don't know. Is it sort of like a Sam's Club?
Yeah, exactly. And more gear. Sam's Club, I guess, is geared towards businesses.
Okay.
Costco, like individuals can sign up for a, you
So
know,
did
a
you
membership.
go and say like
Well,
what's
I
your
thought I
personal
could go.
information? You can't just walk in, I know that.
No, you could walk in. I grabbed a cart and just got some of the stuff I needed. You know, just looked around. I wound up with some stuff I didn't need, but I was like, oh yeah, it's like a 20-pound bag of raisins.
I want explain what you got on your first trip because I'm kind of
So I
curious.
got all the stuff and I'm like, I figure it's like any other membership in any other retail store. Like I'll just buy it
Yeah.
as I go through the line. And apparently that is not, they're like, oh no. Like you have to go over and they got this whole counter dedicated to the membership process. There's,
Oh, I got
I
you.
set my stuff aside and it's to like 30 minutes. Like sign up for a credit card and they have two levels. I wound up signing up for the higher level, $120 a year level, just because that's all the lady would talk about. And at a certain point, I think some of those people they have selling you the extras,
Yeah.
they have in those positions, and because you'll say yes to anything just to get them kind of stop talking.
Sure. Yep.
Yeah, whatever. I wanna go now. I wanna leave. But anyway, so I got signed up. And I got, you know, diapers, baby wipes, got a 48 pack of Mountain Dew, 50 pound bag of oats, carried
What?
it out over my
Wait,
shoulder
stop.
like a farmer.
Was it really 50 pounds? No. That's a lot of oats. What do you do with all those oats?
Oh, I didn't really buy oats, but they had a lot of stuff. You got about like, they got like futons.
You buy any wine?
No, but you can. There's booze. You could buy like a 12 pack of like a whiskey bottle. It's a lot. It's good for
So when you sign up, do they, their last sentence is, "Welcome to Kirkland," because that's the brand, right?
Is it? I don't
Is it
know.
Kirkland? I know more about Costco than you do.
Yeah.
I would
But I'm a
have a date with my
member.
brothers, and they had a Costco, and I was like, "What is this Kirkland stuff?" That's their brand. They had like coffee.
I think the diapers are, yeah, like Kroger is kind of King Soopers. Yeah.
That's
Yeah.
exciting. Would you
Yeah.
recommend it for me?
I guess I have to now. It's I think that's why people are evangelical.
Do
They're
you
one, they're
get
like,
it?
they
Do
got
you get
dupes. They're like, hey, they got, you know, you can buy some macaroni and cheese, you know, like ready-made meals for $10. Really good.
do they have books in there?
No, I could have spent all afternoon in there.
It
It made
sounds
me
like you're
uncomfortable.
a convert.
Yeah, I'll go there again at some point because there
Well,
is
I would
just
hope
a
so.
lot
You
of
have that,
stuff. But
Uber membership.
yeah, I kind of regret that. But I really, she was just like talking and talking. like, okay, I whatever, whatever.
Because the normal one is what, $60?
$60. I spent $120.
There you go.
There's something about how you'll earn your money back or whatever. But hey, big rite of passage for being an adult in your 30s.
It's a big step.
Costco, man.
Very happy for you.
Finally did it.
Maybe this year too, I might join.
Go check it out.
I might go check it out. Just be like, what do? You guys have the 50-pound oats in the back, or are they on the sale for?
Yeah.
Like they're 5 pounds. Like, ugh.
They have a farmer in overalls take it out to your car for you.
No kidding.
This is Hiram. You'll take your oats out to the, you know.
And on that note, welcome to There Will Be Books, a podcast about books and joining Costco. I'm Peter, joined as always by Matt. Matt, part 3, The Count of Monte Cristo. We're going to wrap up the book today. We're going to talk about the 2002 movie adaptation, which I have a lot of thoughts on.
Yeah.
And anything else related to my favorite novel of 2020 that I read. So where do you want to begin?
Well, last time we didn't quite get to what happens to Villefort, who I think is the main villain.
He's
the most responsible, I think.
No, maybe you didn't change your mind. I kind of think it's Dinglaire's in a way.
Yeah, he got things rolling, but Villefort could have stopped it cold, and he should have, because knew Edmund was innocent. But due to his own personal reasons, he decided to send an innocent man to jail.
Villefort also has like the worst kind of revenge.
He does, and that's what I wanted to get into.
I mean, you know,
the worst stuff happens to him.
Yeah, the worst stuff happens to him by far.
And I want to argue that it is karmic and it's fitting, even though the count kind of backs off because it's so horrific.
I mean, yeah, the count is. When it comes to Villefort and the fact that his son dies too, who's kind of, when the son dies, it's sort of like the first time that the count is sort of has some reservations about what he's done.
Oh, he regretted it because he didn't want it to happen. Yes. So what happens is Villefort's kind of exposed that he has this, you know, love child who the count maneuvers Villefort into prosecuting this 20-something young kid from the murder of Caderousse, and the ace up the Count of Monte Cristo's sleeve is that Benedito / Andrea is Villefort's bastard son, but Villefort's unaware of it. And so the whole thing is engineered and like a really perfectly done, like story-wise, tension-wise.
Yeah.
The whole thing is engineered to where there's a big reveal in court that Benedito is Villefort's son, and it just ruins Villefort's career after Monte Cristo's kind of engineered it to where Villefort's whole family gets poisoned by his wife.
Second wife.
Yeah. So his whole life is ruined and he's publicly shamed. And that was going to be the count's like vengeance, just ruin his career, you know, ruin his family, that type of thing. But what happens is Villefort finds out that his wife poisoned everybody in his family and poisoned his daughter, Valentine, who it is assumed she's dead. Spoiler, you know.
Yeah, spoiler, she's dead.
Fakes her death.
Yeah.
But Villefort thinks she's dead. And so he kind of basically, right before he storms off to court, he tells his wife basically, you're going to kill yourself to remove the shame from the family. And he's very strict about it. Mm-hmm. The wife is kind of like, no, I don't want to. But he's like, no, you will do this. And then he goes up to court and gets his comeuppance in court. And as he goes back, he decides because he's ruined, he wants his wife to live. And so he goes home and he finds his wife's dead, but his wife also poisoned their 8-year-old son.
Yeah.
And then that's when the count kind of backs off. He's like, whoa, I didn't want it to go this far. He tries to save the kid. Even though the kid's a brat, he wasn't part of the count's vengeance.
Yeah, it's really the first, and really, I would say it's the main instance of regret. But I don't know. Do you think at the end of the day, I think he's content maybe with what he's done.
Yeah, well, I think that causes him to back off of Danglars.
Yes,
because Danglars hasn't, his vengeance for Danglars is in motion, but it kind of hasn't played out yet. But I think, because the Count winds up giving kind of mercy to Danglars, so that's, I think, what kind of spurs that, the Count's willingness to kind of relatively go easy on Danglars, is the fact that, you know, he thought he'd gone too far with Villefort. So, but what I want to argue is sort of, it's not quite, ironic's not the right word, but it's fitting for Villefort that all that happened. The fact that the Count pulled back and regretted it, and the fact that it wasn't in his plans to poison an 8-year-old, like, show that he's still human. And for all his talk of being a divine agent of vengeance, he's still a human being under there, that he was horrified by it. But the Count's modus operandi when it comes to vengeance is finding people's weakness or their flaws as human beings, and kind of just almost like a wind-up toy, like winding them up and setting them in motion. And so it's karmic what happens to Villefort, even though the Count regrets it. Because what spurs his wife to poison their son is Villefort being so harsh when it comes to meeting out justice. And I think what makes it fitting karmically is the fact that, like, Villefort, his whole career, he became a prosecutor and then a judge. So he's meeting out this kind of strict iron-like law form of justice. And how many countless people has he done that to? You know, by punishing a guilty party to the full extent of the law, how many other how many families has he ruined, you know, by the same domino effect that he in turn sets off with his wife? You know what I mean? So by insisting that his wife kill herself for shame, he doesn't see, he sees for the first time the effects that kind of stringent justice has on people. So I think that's kind of what makes it fitting. And story-wise, you can't have the hero of the story willingly poison an 8-year-old. So the Count backs off. And it is significant that he becomes human and that he goes off to find happiness with Haiti and all that.
Well, I was going to ask you, I think it's an interesting choice that he does. I was sort of expecting him and Mercedes to sort of rekindle their. They have a kind of a. She definitely has a lot of regret and sort of.
Do you think that's her punishment?
A lot of scarring, I guess. A lot of, like, self kind of exile and punishment she's enacting on herself.
Yeah.
Do you think that's
self-inflicted? Or do you think that's part of his plan? Because she did turn around and marry Ferdinand.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's like, I think it's a gray area. I don't think she's nearly as culpable and with kind of our three main villains. She's I don't know. It's like she thought he died and she didn't know the whole story and she was kind of duped by Ferdinand. So I don't know. It was interesting. I was fine with it. And then when he goes off and kind of spends the rest of his life with Haiti, I was fine with that too. I just thought it was an interesting, like, as we will talk about in the movie has him and her, like,
them. Well, and I think that's interesting because it would have been a more satisfying story from a, you know, what you're rooting for.
I mean, yeah, because I don't know if you're thinking of it, this novel's kind of a crowd pleaser in some ways. Like, you have certain delineated lines about who's good and bad, and, you know, the bad people are good. And this is one time where I think it doesn't play into that, really.
People were
probably hoping that they would end up together.
You're rooting for it. It's a nice story. And when I say it would have been more fulfilling, I don't mean that, like, the story would have been better. I think this serves the story well, kind of gives it a little more heft.
Some of my favorite parts of the novel are when, at the very end, and I'm going to read this section out, it's Monte Cristo and Mercedes are having these, like, very in-depth conversations about, like...
In the garden in Marseille?
Yeah. And at one point, I'll read from kind of the middle of this paragraph. He goes, "Then suddenly, after captivity, solitude, and misery, air, freedom, and a fortune so brilliant, so imposing and so extravagant that, unless I was blind, I must have thought that God has sent it to me for some great purpose. And I'll stop there. The reference to God again, I think, is an important motif throughout the novel. Yeah. From then on, that fortune seemed to me a holy vocation. From then on, there was not one further thought in me for that life, the sweetness of which you, poor woman, have sometimes partaken. Not an hour of calm, not a single hour. I felt myself driven like a cloud of flame through the sky to destroy the cities of the plain. I mean, that's like vengeance right there. That is pure. Well, you can see how motivated he was. What motivates him? It's a lot of like internal, like code of a code of like, this is what I have to stick to.
I think that sort of at least conceiving yourself in those terms as an agent of God or providence is what separates him from just a person being out for petty vengeance and, you know, this entity who is able to fathom and strategize and plan this really elaborate vengeance.
Yeah. You know, it's almost like the second chance or the chance he's been given. He's not going to relinquish that. And any sort of wavering just doesn't enter his mind.
Well, until the end, I liked that there's a little chapter after Villefort and before he goes to finish up Danglars, where he does, he goes to back to the Chateau d'If, the prison.
Yeah. Oh, that's true.
To kind of wrestle with it, almost to like refresh his sense of vengeance, to remind himself why he's doing it. So by this time, it's not a prison anymore. It's a tourist, kind of like Alcatraz is now. It's like a tourist attraction. So we can just go in, and it's kind of fun watching him talk to like basically a tour guide. The tour guide shows him the cell and tells him the story of what happened. And it's kind of cool. He's like talking to the guy who was there and telling him the legend of what they think happened. Which is they knew he switched bodies with Abbe Faria, but they just assume he drowned because they threw him off the cliff with a cannonball around him. But anyway, that's a nice scene. And then he like goes to renew his sense of vengeance and he finishes off Danglars, but he lets him live. He has him kidnapped.
Kept in almost like in a spiritual sense, like he has to repent for what he's done in a way.
But and he also wanted to keep the fire burning.
Yeah.
Rather, you know, he's like, do I want to even follow through with the Danglars business? And then being in the cell reminded him of like, oh, yeah, like his original motivations. And he decides to go through with it. But spare Danglars' life, just bankrupts him. And
yeah. And then we're left with sort of his almost like a project of like, what's the happiness that's going to come out of it, out of the situation?
Which leads me to the other thing I want to talk about, which is the love story between Maximilian Morel and Valentine, Villefort's daughter. And that is the happiness that he wants to bring to the situation. Because he loves the Morels because his old boss, you know, was the only person who stood up for him. And he'll do anything for Maximilian. And originally, he was going to let Valentine, Villefort's daughter, die by poisoning because he's just kind of ambivalent. But he finds out Maximilian is in love with Valentine in a very Romeo and Juliet and actually Pyramus and Thisbe type of way, which that's the Pyramus and Thisbe legend is actually kind of referenced a lot. And that's an interesting, I went and kind of looked it up because it was referenced so much. That's an interesting story. And it's actually the basis of Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah, it's like an ancient story. It's from like, it takes place in Babylon. And Pyramus and Thisbe, like their families don't get along, but they fall in love with each other and talk through a wall. Like,
okay.
You know, little stone walls in old Babylon, which Maximilian and Valentine talk through the fence. All sorts of, and so they decide they're going to marry in secret because their families will never consent to have them married. So they agree to meet underneath this tree out in the countryside at a certain time and day. Thisbe, the girl, goes out there first, and she sees a lion under the tree, and so she gets scared and runs away, but she drops her scarf or shawl there, And so she's alive, and she just runs away. But Pyramus comes and sees, like, the lion with a shawl, and he assumes the lion killed Thisbe, and there's misunderstandings, and Pyramus kills himself, and Thisbe finds the body, and, you know, whatever. They both kill themselves due to misunderstandings. And that's pretty much, it's like, oh, so that's where Shakespeare got
wrong. Maximilian is, in this novel, wanting to kill himself. So
that is purposely, he's telling the story of Pyramus and Thisbe through Maximilian and Valentine, like almost exactly.
Well, and also, and, like, the Count is sort of almost testing him to be like, are you sure you want to marry this person?
Well, and the Count is the lion.
Okay.
In the Pyramus and Thisbe story, I'm pretty sure he means the Count to be the lion.
Okay.
Like, sort of test, like the trial who tests the love of Pyramus and Thisbe. And this has a happy ending, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're wondering, so...
See, I always thought she was alive, even though she was, like, presumed dead.
Yeah, me too.
I kind of, there was enough things I was like, I don't think that, I had not read the ending ahead or whatever. I'd never looked or read something, oh, this is how it ends. I just had a feeling.
Yeah, you're meant to think, he hints that it is, because he's looking after her and tells her to drink something. So you're pretty sure that he gave her a drug that would make her fall asleep.
Right? Yeah.
But that is, yeah, it is kind of a Count playing with Maximilian, knowing the Count from the Count's
point. Because he doesn't really, when he first hears about them, he doesn't like, he's not like, oh, that's great.
He could tell him. So basically, he helped Valentine fake her death. He let, as part of his vengeance against Villefort, he lets everybody think she died. Mm-hmm. But he gave her some drug that makes it seem like she's asleep, but they go through this whole ritual of a funeral. And the Count, knowing all this, lets Maximilian think that she's dead. At any point in time, they talk.
Yeah.
Multiple times before the ending.
He could have told him at any time that she's
alive, and he didn't.
But doesn't he say, like, wait one second?
He keeps telling the hope, and then Maximilian's like, I don't know how I could. And actually, one of my least favorite things in stories is mopey romanticism.
Yeah.
Well, I actually don't like Romeo and Juliet that much, just because it's all mopey romantic. But, and then the last little bit with Maximilian and Valentine was kind of like, oh, I should, you know, what's the stupid quote I highlighted? When Maximilian thinks Valentine's dead, is like, it is in Paris where Valentine rests, and leaving Paris is to lose her for a second time. Just all that sort of mopey.
Yeah.
But it's the Count purposefully doing it, because from the Count's point of view, he thinks or knows that true happiness comes from coming face to face with losing it all. When you're so miserable, you want to die, and you're spared at the last second.
That's
where he believes ultimate happiness or the spur that made the Count into something, you know? So he's kind of purposely, we realize by the end, he purposely did that to Maximilian.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of take, to fully realize your potential, you have to hit a dark, deep valley or rock bottom or whatever. It almost seems to be the Count sort of how he operates, I guess. And he's, you know, for Maximilian, he has to, you know, he's almost like, are you at your bottom? You sure you're at your bombs? Don't go, you know, don't kill yourself.
Well, yeah. He's like, you still want to kill yourself? And then the Count offers him money. He's like, do you want, you know? And then the fact that Maximilian still thinks Valentine's dead and turns down the Count's money, that's when he decides, okay, this guy's worthy.
Yeah, he does that. Who else does he do that with, where he kind of like tests them? Like, what are your motivations?
Albert a little bit.
Calderus, sort of, who
ultimately fails the test.
He fails the test. He ultimately fails the test. But he does do these sort of
Danglars.
Yeah.
Even before he ultimately lets him off, before when he, because he sets about bankrupting him. And then, like, there's a lot of financial ledger domain. Mm-hmm. Right. So, but right before Danglars basically signs a piece of paper that's going to bankrupt him, the Count pauses and is like, are you sure? Mm-hmm. So he really does give them a chance
But I think
had they been reformed people, I don't think he would have gone forward with his revenge.
I think it's an interesting question because I almost feel like he knows them so well that he knows their answer.
He's not worried about it, but not if they worried did,
that, but yeah,
I think he would have called it off. He's got to give him the chance.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
Which, and it's what he's an agent of fate or God. You know, he tests people, gives them trials, and if they come through, he will reward you, and if they don't, he will condemn you. You know, that's
he's a great character. But in like real life, if you were to meet a guy like this, you'd be so annoyed because he's like gone through all this stuff and he expects so much of everyone else because he has succeeded and like been through. And you're like, come on, man.
Dude, I'm just trying to watch TV here. Like, what?
What'd you say?
Dude, I'm just trying to watch TV here, man.
I know. And you're like, oh, man. Like, I get it. You're better than me. I don't know. I was just thinking, like, he'd kind of be a pain in the ass. If he was like, you know, I spent 14 years in prison by myself and learned, you know, everything about anything. I'd be like, well, I feel terrible about myself anyway. you know, you'd just be like, I don't know. It would be, for some people, that might be motivation. For others, it might be like, I don't know if this is going to work out as a friendship.
Yeah. Like you start ducking his calls. Like, I don't want to.
You just be like, I took a nap today. You'd be like, you wasted an hour of your precious day. And you'd be like, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I was on Twitter, but don't. Yeah, you start ducking his calls. It's like, ah, man, he's going to chide me about my life choices. I don't really want to hang out with the count today.
Yeah, you just be like, he probably did something. He probably knows something else that I don't know.
Sorry, bro. Sick.
Sorry.
Rain check. Just keep it's a month of like rain check, bro. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I'd be happy for him, but I'd just be like, I don't know. You should probably just not have friends because they'll all disappoint you. Maybe. I don't know. that's my opinion on old you account.
You would not be friends with the count.
I would not be friends with the count. I love him as a character. I think he's great. I think what he's doing is great. Great job. Great job by him. But if we're hanging out, if we're on a Zoom call, he's probably just going to be judging me a lot. He's smarter than me. He's going to be doing all these, like, you know.
Well, he's a stoic by nature.
Oh. That's
another thing I noticed all the way through. There's some stoicism in there.
He doesn't react. He rarely.
Well, and stoicism emotions. As a philosophy is more than just keeping a straight face, which kind of how it's come to mean. It's about accepting the things you can't change and realizing the only thing you can control is your response to situations. You can't control the situations themselves or like what comes at you in life, but you can control your reaction. So I'd be very surprised if Dumas hadn't read like Marcus Aurelius and Seneca and some of the other Stoics, because it's pretty explicit like throughout. There's a couple of, this is the count speaking. Only a weak spirit sees everything from behind a dark veil. The soul makes its own horizons. Your soul is overcast, and that is why the sky seems stormy to you. That's him talking to Maximilian when he's trying to get him to, you know, have a little hope. And Maximilian refuses because he thinks the love of his life is dead. But that's a very stoic sentiment. And then when the count's talking to Mercedes about Albert, and Albert's going off to join the military and Mercedes is worried for him, the count tells her, now he will become great and strong by struggling against adversities that he will change into good fortune, which is another very stoic sentiment. So there's a vein of stoicism running through it. And there's one part, there's a little bit of a Nietzsche in there, which once again, like the parallels to Sherlock Holmes, this predates Nietzsche, which is kind of interesting. Yeah, I mean, Nietzsche was born in 1844.
Okay.
So.
That's interesting.
But this sounds, you could like quote this and put Nietzsche by it, and most people would be like, oh yeah, that sounds like something you'd say. But this is the count talking about the count. A man of the Count stamp could not long exist in that state of melancholy which may give life to vulgar souls by endowing them with the appearance of originality, but which destroys superior beings. And that's the Übermensch and, you know, Nietzsche. Yeah. And Nietzsche believed you had to kind of, and called the spirit or the soul like a big tree with like roots that go deep down to, you know, displeasure and pain, and then, you know, your branches will reach up to the sky, so you're just big enough to encompass the good and bad that life has to offer. And that's what Nietzsche said, you know, 50 years after Count of Monte Cristo, says something remarkably similar to Nietzsche's philosophy.
Different readers, different interpretations. You have very in-depth, well thought out ideas, and I just go, I don't know if I want to be friends with him.
Probably wouldn't hang out with him.
I probably wouldn't hang out with him.
No, but it, like, this is
good points. You're making excellent points.
Had this book not existed, there's no Batman, no okay. Sherlock Holmes, and I won't go as far to say there's no Nietzsche, but
Sherlock Holmes is a very interesting tie in. I was not expecting that.
We talked about it last time. Mm-hmm. But literally the line, he says, elementary, my dear Morcerf. That is verbatim.
Although, hold on.
Verbatim.
Translations, though.
Ooh, yeah, that would be.
That is, we're not.
Something to look into. I frankly don't want to do it. So
I know, we're just going to assume.
French and want to. I'm curious about, yeah, the translation.
Yeah.
How that's translated.
Because
if in the English version before this, because this translation is a very, very good translation. But
yeah,
the translation,
one I have, the Robin Bus is from 1996.
Yeah. Well, I just, in the English translation that Conan Doyle would have read, was it translated like that? And watch the original.
That's true.
The astute listener. Email us in about that. And I'm also curious, did Nietzsche read this book?
There you go.
Nietzsche took himself pretty seriously, so he might not have read, you know. But I'm just curious. There's a lot of Nietzschean stoicism in there. Very good. There's a lot going on. And like we said, this counts as like real literature.
Real. Very real. Serious literature. Seriously. Exciting literature, but a lot of different things.
It's serious. Yeah.
Let's transition to the 2002...
Yeah.
Adaptation starring Jim Caviezel, Guy Pearce.
We both watched it.
I want to
ask you right off, Peter, did you like it?
Here's my take. Guy Pearce is terrible in this movie.
Oh, really?
I thought he was terrible.
I thought he was.
No.
All right, go ahead. Get your.
Not convince me. Guy Pearce plays Ferdinand, and he has a very strange. They changed the role of him. Did I like this movie? No, I did not.
Okay.
I liked one aspect of the movie I thought did well. I wrote down, what did this movie do? Okay. First of all, I had to try and change my opinion or how I viewed it because you can't make a 2-hour movie out of a 1200 page book.
You
attempt it. I was thinking, what would I leave out? I think what they left out was, I have some issues with, but some of it I understand. But the only thing I really liked was his relationship with the Abbé Ferrara. I thought that was the best part of the adaptation. Is sort of, I don't know, when they're digging and he's kind of quizzing him and he's like, no, in Italian, like, you know, tell me blah, blah, blah. I was like, okay, I like this.
That montage, yeah.
Almost everything else I did not. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people like it. I saw one thing on Amazon. It's like, really good movie. Probably don't watch it if you've read the book.
Yeah, because I think, and so I will say I liked it.
You did, but like it. Okay.
Going in, I kind of like had to brace. I was like, okay, so this is just going to be different. And I watched it with my wife.
Mm-hmm.
I had to catch myself. Because at first I was like that annoying guy who was like, that's not in the book. That's not in the book. And then I realized by a mixture of her like kind of side-eyed looking at me and just like, oh, I'm going to be saying this every like 30 seconds. So just, okay, I'm just going to stop pointing that out. But so I liked it. I decided to give it the benefit of the doubt and just enjoy it. And so, the reason I'm willing to do that is because they had to take this 1200 page book and winnow it down to 2 hours. And so the changes they made, they kind of make Ferdinand's character
way more important.
It, not at all what he was in the book.
Yeah.
A mixture of Danglars and Ferdinand's more
complex. I thought Villefort was sort of, I could see Villefort in that character in the movie. But
to give the story the momentum, they can't kind of make Ferdinand what he was in the book because there's just not enough time. So you gotta, so the fact that in the movie, they're lifelong friends.
Yeah, I saw when I was watching it, like on Amazon, they have like this thing where like kind of if you click on it, it like will tell you like a trivia or a fun fact or whatever.
Yeah.
The screenwriter wanted to make it so Ferdinand was like it was almost like a best friend type thing where it was like a more of a friend movie, I guess, where a betrayal of friends.
Yeah. Well, and you don't have, you know, the 10 pages of exposition you have in the book.
Yeah.
So just the fact you just mentioned, hey, they're lifelong friends. That's your exposition right there. It makes the betrayal more powerful rather than just spelling out.
Here's like, my thing. I think that some of the scenes, like the scene early on in the book where Dinglers is basically explains why, or he kind of uses Ferdinand's to kind of set in motion the betrayal. Is that I think just have that scene in there and then we kind of understand their motivations. I don't know. And then I think how they explained Villefort's, I think that was probably the best explanation of why he's doing things.
I don't know why they changed his name.
What?
In the book, it's Nortier.
Yeah, I didn't understand that either. Why did they change the father's name?
You know, like I don't. But yeah, no, they did Villefort well. You know what I liked? I appreciated they kind of made it into like a swashbuckler.
Yeah,
like in the 50s. And you know what? It didn't dawn on me until watching the movie. There's no sword fights in the book. There's no gunplay.
No.
There's a threatened duel that doesn't come through, and Ferdinand and the Count almost duel, but Ferdinand just runs away and kills himself.
Yeah,
but I didn't realize because you would think Dumas and the Count of Monte Cristo, yeah, that's a swashbuckling sword fight.
After the Three Musketeers, no.
But I'm okay with making the movie into that. Once I decided to just sit back and enjoy it, I was like, okay, fine. You know what? They had to give the story heft and momentum, and like we mentioned, they do make it to where not only do the Count and Mercedes get back together, but they make it to where Albert, or they say Albert in the movie. It made me feel silly because we've done 2 episodes calling him Albert. But
hey, we can call him Albert.
But they make Albert the Count's son and not Ferdinand.
Yeah, which is actually, I was fine with.
Me too.
In the book, it's... I think it's an interesting thing. It could have easily been in the book, you know. A lot of times in the book, there are like you know, who is actually the parents, sort of with Villefort and Madame de Glare's kind of like.
Yeah, with Benedito. And
yeah, Benedito. Sort of,
not really with Albert.
I did enjoy the kind of, it almost seemed like a grouping of characters into. Luis Guzman.
Yeah. Ali and all his whole.
Yeah, I kind of was okay with that. I was like, okay, there's too many characters in the book to put in a movie this long. And yeah. I was okay with that. I thought it was kind of interesting.
Concentrated into one loyal servant. Yeah. Well, I
thought they weren't going to go to Italy, but they kind of sort of in a
goes to Rome.
Yeah. I was almost like, you should not have even done this. I don't know. It was kind of like, it was a weird shift in the movie. We're like, hey, we're in Rome now. Cause he's just like, father, I have to go to Rome. Declares So I don't know. It made me want,
like,
here's what I want. I want a very long in-depth series. Okay. And yes, instead of taking things out, I want you to add stuff.
Everything. Like a big HBO production.
Or Amazon, because they're making shows now. But
big budget. Yeah.
you add stuff, like the book doesn't stay on the Count's life the whole time. You can go in and flush out these characters that, you know, what happens to Villefort? What happens to Glares? What happens to Ferdinand after he goes to prison? And sort of, I think you can kind of piece together what we know from what happens to them, but just kind of expand. I don't know. You can go into the Napoleon thing. I mean, the movie, Napoleon's not really a character in the book in a sense.
No, yeah, and that's another thing. In the movie, it starts off and they go to Elba and meet Napoleon.
Yeah, I was like,
I'm fine with, but it was kind of funny. I did one thing. I was like a stickler about, like, they kind of, there's a mistaken identity, like, you're not supposed to land on Elba, or the British troops guarding Napoleon will kill you because they'll think you're trying to rescue him. Whatever. So the British troops see Edmund and Ferdinand landing and they're about to kill him, but then Napoleon calls off the British. And I was like, I don't think Napoleon was able to command his guards. You know what I mean? You know, intimidating presence, but it's like, I don't know.
And I thought, I was like, they ran up this hill and I was like, I was like, they're just surrounded. And then they somehow get out of it. And I was like, what's going on right
but
now?
But whatever, they started off with sword playing guns, which I'm fine with. But yeah, they meet and talk to Napoleon, but you can flesh that whole thing out. I'm with you. A big, long series. It's sitting there. Hollywood's out of ideas. Like, this is surely in the public domain. Like, it's staring you in the face.
I think there is. I saw someone, there is a adaptation that's still in the works right now. I don't know exactly when that will be made, but it's like someone bought the rights to it, I guess, again, or whatever. We'll
cast it here in a sec. I do want to talk, my last note about the movie.
Yeah.
Was how they did Luigi Vampa, the Italian bandit.
I kind of liked him, actually.
Really? Because I thought, so as soon as he escapes from the Chateau d'If, he washes up on an island and there's this fat guy laying on the beach model. And he's supposed to be like intimidating, you know, like he's about to kill one of his men for theft or whatever. And he's just laying there like, you know, and as a gentleman who runs towards Pudgy myself, who ironically happened to be laying exactly like that on his couch, I was like, oh, that's not intimidating. Like, his guts touching the sand. He's supposed to... I did not picture Luigi Vampa quite like that.
No. I don't actually kind of like the casting of that guy. I did not. Guy Pearce was terrible in this movie. He's terrible.
I like Guy Pearce. I thought he was fun.
That's not what Ferdinand is, though.
Well, no, but like I'm fine with. I think they had to concentrate a lot of different energies into the character just to give the story like a rocket launch, just to give it more of a boost. There's no backstory necessary if they're like lifetime friends. That makes the family listen. I saw an interview with Steven Spielberg, right?
Yeah.
Steven Spielberg is talking about Indiana Jones. And he's like, one of the benefits of having it be in the 30s in Nazi Germany is you don't have to give backstory on why these guys are the bad guys.
Okay.
You see the little swastika armband and you don't have to spend 10, 15 minutes showing them being evil. You just know. And then the story goes along that much quicker. So I'm fine. I think, and they made Ferdinand more of a, almost like an operatic.
How do you say? He's just
a villain, almost a cartoonish villain. He's a very bad.
Yeah. Like kills a guy just for no reason. Mercedes, at one point.
Kills people, you know, but
he's much more, he's a bigger villain.
Yeah. He hams it up, I guess.
Yeah.
I was okay with it just because that just gives it that much more momentum to get through a 2-hour story without a lot of fat.
Yeah.
Louis Vampa type fat.
Do you want to do some like casting? What would you want?
Yeah. So who are you thinking? If you're casting a big, let's say HBO, multi-million dollar.
Here's what I want. I don't know which. I struggle with what character I want, but here are the names I want. We're going to set this in the time, but I want, here are the three actors I want.
Okay.
And we can kind of fill it out maybe with some lesser known, because this might be expensive to get all three. I want Ryan Gosling in this thing.
As the Count?
No.
As maybe, one of the villains?
I have as maybe Ferdinand or possibly Albert. He's a little old now.
I don't know if he's young enough to play Albert. He could be, right at that age to where he could play both the old version of Ferdinand or whoever and the young version.
What about this? Rachel Weisz as Mercedes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I like that.
You know how you can change stuff? This is a retelling, okay? Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah.
Good actor.
I would be fine with him being the Count.
Yeah?
That would add a little, yeah, the racial element would add a little oomph to it.
He's also a good actor, good name. We got to get big name in there. Okay, I have a couple other people, but I don't think they'll work because I think they're older. But I want John Malkovich.
He'd have to be Abbe Faria.
Yes. Or he could be...
Or Dinglars. Dinglars.
Yes, Dinglars is a little bit older. What was it? Paul Giamatti. You know what? Why are you laughing at Paul Giamatti?
Be Cataruse. I picture Cataruse as like taller and thicker, but I'd be willing to have Giovanni be
Giamatti. Also, you know how sometimes you do like casting of like people that are no longer alive? Like
yeah, classic. Dream casting.
Dream
yeah.
casting. I don't know who, but I would want Philip Seymour Hoffman in this.
Yeah.
As almost like an assistant, like not a leading role, but just sort of like someone who the Count uses.
When, like, what's his name? The journalist.
Oh, yeah.
There with Madame Danglars.
Sort of like any scene he's in, he steals the scene.
Yeah. Yeah. He's good at that.
What were you some of the people you were thinking of?
Okay, so here's what I did.
Ryan Reynolds?
Trouble because I cast specific roles.
Okay.
But I didn't want to look up. I don't know a lot of young actors, and I didn't want to look them up. So you know what I did?
Yeah.
Muppet Count of Monte Cristo. God. Okay. But you can have real
people. Why do you do this? You do this every time.
Because it's fun.
Okay.
You have real people in it, too. Like Muppet, it's, you know. In Muppet Christmas Carol, Michael Caine was Scrooge. Like it's so.
Michael Caine would be a good Abbe.
Ian McKellen.
Very good.
Is my Abbe Faria.
That's pretty good.
A real person. I'll do the real people first. The Count is somebody who is actually in the movie, but he'd be a different character.
Oh,
Henry Cavill.
Henry Cavill
is the Count.
It's pretty good.
He's Albert in the movie.
I know. I didn't realize that. He's very young. He's like,
he has a different body type now. You know.
Yeah. There you go.
But, you know, side note, just doing my research on this guy, he might be my new favorite actor.
Really? Henry Cavill?
Did you know he's a Chiefs fan?
That's the reason why he's your Chiefs favorite. Fan? Okay.
And do you know why?
He's from Kansas City.
No, he's British.
Oh.
But he likes the Chiefs because that is who Superman would probably go for.
That's an insane reason. That is a crazy reason.
I had never thought of that before, but yeah, Superman would likely be a Chiefs and a Royals.
He's from Kansas, right?
He's from Western Kansas, so he's probably a K-State fan too.
Probably a Broncos fan, let's be honest.
Henry Cavill, British guy, Chiefs fan, my new favorite actor, and he's going to play the Count.
Ooh, you know who I thought of? Just an actor I like is Michael Shannon. You don't know who he is, but look him up after you.
No, I know who he is.
You know who Michael Shannon is?
The wife and I watched Groundhog Day. And do you know he's actually in Groundhog Day for like?
No, I did not know that.
Have you seen Groundhog Day?
I have seen Groundhog Day.
Yeah. He's like a young guy. He's got like a 30-second bit part in it. No, I know who Michael Shannon is, son.
He's good.
He's the villain in Superman.
He is also in Revolutionary Road.
Oh, I haven't seen
Leonardo that. DiCaprio.
It looked boring as hell.
Oh my God.
But a good movie.
Such a ridiculous statement.
Like a serious.
Boring as hell. Stop. It's a great book, Richard Yates. Super depressing.
So that, exactly.
So good.
Right up. Anyway. Okay.
Right up my alley. All right. Continue.
Okay. Ferdinand. McNulty. Dominic West.
That's funny. I was thinking of McNulty too for The Wire.
He'd be an all right count actually too, but
I think he's a bad guy though.
He played Ferdinand.
Yeah.
Maybe Villefort. You know my Villefort is.
Who?
Your favorite guy, Benedict Cumberbund.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a pretty solid. And then is what's his face? Ian McKellen. That's good. And Mercedes, you know who Sienna Miller is?
Okay. I can see that.
Yeah. Her or Rachel Weisz, you know, that. And then we get into the Muppet. Danglars is Sam the Eagle.
You know, I can't. You just say the Muppets, and I don't know who they are.
I'm going to address the audience for this. Yep. Max and Valentine are Kermit and Miss Piggy.
That's good, Mac. I like that one.
Well, you know who Kermit the Frog is.
Yeah, I know. I'm just. But
right? So you get Kermit moping around, you know.
In the audience.
Go away, counting, and no, let me kill myself in peace.
Right? Is that a Kermit impersonation?
I guess so, yeah. Albert, it's Fozzie Bear. But Waka Waka,
just keep going.
I challenge you to a duel because you framed my father. Impressions.
Keep going.
Vampa is Gonzo. Catarouse, Rizzo the Rat.
Can you please do all these impersonations? You can't.
No, I can only do
no.
Fozzie Bear and Kermit, and they're kind of the same. My Fozzie Bear and my Kermit are same deal. Or, Nortier are the cranky two old dudes.
Oh, like, yeah, that's pretty good. I know who they are.
I know we can't talk in the movie, but maybe you're just privy to their thoughts. But that's like the perfect.
Were you hoping in the book that he would eventually like say something?
Say something, yeah.
I was like, oh, come on, man, like say he'd something.
Say he'd gather his gather his strength and say one last. Or he'd be the one to point to Mademoiselle.
Yeah, I was expecting that the whole time. I was like, oh, you're going to say something, right? You got to say something. Yeah. He didn't say
it. Or if he's faking it the whole time, that'd be fun.
He's just busy poisoning himself so he can't get poisoned. That takes some dedication.
All right. Bunsen Honeydew and Beaker will be kind of in tandem, Villefort's doctor who figures out that there's poison. Swedish chef will work for the count and cook all his delicious meals.
Okay.
And Ali, the servant, is animal.
Okay.
It's pretty good Muppet.
That's pretty good.
I watched The Great Muppet Caper to kind of prepare for this.
I like it.
Work on the casting.
So ridiculous. We did get your impersonation, so it wasn't all, you know, without merit. So I just want them to do an adaptation where they spend a lot of money and they blow it out and they just make it big and they just go, hey, we're doing all of it. We're doing all the intrigue and all the characters are going to be in it.
Yeah.
And we're making 5 seasons of this.
It's staring you right in the face too, because it's in the public domain. Yeah. It's cheap. The material's all there. They really should do it. You know, here's another thing I thought of. They did it in the movie, and actually in my head, and actually in our casting, it's there. You kind of take it for granted. But this is like a French thing. It takes place in France and Italy, and they're all French characters, but they're all British actors. And I think it would work. Even the Americans, like in your version, Gosling would put on a British accent, because I think in Americans' mind, it's just like, okay, this is all Europe.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, you can even just like get like some European actors we don't know and just be like, what I want is like, you know how we talked about earlier, like how Shakespearean some of the scenes are? Like, let the scenes play out, like long takes, like really characters manipulating each other, and there's upper hands, and, you know, just like let that part of the novel shine through. Because, like, the movie from 2002 is a lot of like action and exciting and revenge. And I think that's what a lot of people think that the book is, sort of like this basic surface. I don't know. But, like, I thought. In the book, there's just so much like the scenes of, you know, we talked about like how he describes like medicine poisoning to a character who eventually commits and poisons a bunch of people. Mm-hmm. Like all that like setup and build up and complexity, and you know, it's, I don't know, it's just missing. And that's, I don't, that's what's so good about the novel.
It's perfect for it perfect for episodic TV. Yeah. You can draw it out. It's very dramatic. Like I say, there's no sword fights. It's not a swashbuckling book. It's cool. It's exciting.
It's fun, exciting and just sort of the, yeah.
It's not sword. It's not pirates and sword play. So no, you're right. It's perfect for
Hollywood.
Do it. Adaptation. Do it.
Come on. All right, Matt, let the listener know, we do have another episode we're going to record here shortly, where we're going to be talking about some new books, specifically Fake Accounts, the new kind of much talked about fiction debut. She's written a lot of criticisms, nonfiction works. We were very kindly sent some advanced copies of that book, and we'll have an episode coming out shortly. Maybe about a couple days after this one comes out, we'll be kind of delving into that book. A lot to discuss. I have a feeling we're gonna maybe disagree on some things.
It'll be interesting to talk about.
Yes,
I liked it. I found it fascinating, but I'm curious to flesh it out.
I think it's a book that you can talk a lot about. I will also be telling Matt about three new books I've recently read, also new fiction books. I've been reading quite a bit. Two recommends in that list, and then one sort of lukewarm, but those will kind of be, I'll kind of just kind of briefly describe my thoughts on those books, but mostly we'll be talking about Fake Accounts. So be on the lookout for that episode after this one. So the listener can get in contact with us and follow us in a couple different ways. We're on Instagram, we're on Goodreads, and we're on Twitter. Those are the three kind of biggies there. Mm-hmm. We're also on Ko-fi as a way to donate money and support the channel, or not support the channel, support the podcast. And also, Matt, you have news. You've set up a Patreon account.
Patreon's up and running.
Patreon is up and running as we kind of test out this kind of new way to kind of have people support the podcast. Do you want to say anything more about that? Or
no, we're looking to kind of make it interactive. We might have like a Patreon book club. Like our book of the month will be Patreon driven. And then, you know, subscribers will get, you know, access to select episodes, maybe like voting rights on what we read. Like, you know, you can read along, suggest books. There's no episodes. The Patreon's up and running. The site's good to go, but we don't have any episodes.
Yeah. And it's, I don't know, like, it's just fun to talk about stories, you know? It's just like, I think a lot of people, like, I don't know, before we started this, I don't know about you, I would just like read books and not really talk about them at all to anybody. It's kind of nice. I don't know if other people have that same feeling. So it's kind of open to be a place where people can discuss books and disagree on books in a friendly manner, and just sort of, I don't know, a community is what I'm hoping for. Yeah. So
it's nice to have an outlet.
Yeah, definitely. I think it also helps your reading. At least it has for me, where I'm like, let me, you know, maybe not pay attention more, but let me like gather my thoughts more and sort of have been more of a formed opinion about something. So
exactly. Yeah.
Matt, do you have any final thoughts, words of wisdom, life coach advice
for the listener? Well, wrapping up The Count of Monte Cristo, big long story, is a perfect quote. It's a good quote. I think you can maybe use it in your personal life too.
High school yearbook.
We'll see. Yeah. Well, mankind is an ugly worm when you look at it through a solar microscope. But I think you said I have nothing to do. Now, Monsieur, I ask you, do you imagine you have anything to do? Or, to put it more clearly, do you believe what you do deserves to be called something? You know why I like that? That is the count talking to Bill for it, but it's also a good comeback if anybody makes fun of you for having a podcast. Like, oh, I was a podcast on the internet. And they're like, oh, yeah, you're the only one. Original idea. And you come around with, oh, what do you do? You know, only literate-like.
On that note, we'll talk to you soon.